The strategic approach to revolution and its relation to basic questions of epistemology and method. I want to start by looking a little bit into and digging further into some of the what's in the six paragraphs that have been focused on from part two of Making Revolution and Emancipating Humanity. Now, those six paragraphs begin under the heading, of the broad heading of Enrich What Is to Be Doneism, but the particular heading of which once again encapsulates a very basic principle of our whole approach to making revolution, namely hastening while awaiting, and then is added, not bowing down to necessity. And this contradiction or opposition that's posed between the correct orientation of hastening while awaiting and also in an all too common tendency and a very powerful pull toward bowing down to necessity is a very important one to examine a bit. In the second of these six paragraphs, the one that begins, I spoke earlier about the outlook and an approach of revisionist determinist realism. Toward the middle of that paragraph, it says that this determinist realism doesn't really or fully grasp the contradictoriness of all of reality, including the necessity that one is confronted with at any given time. Now, in another context, and in fact repeatedly, I have stressed and we have been stressing that the basis for revolution lies in the very contradictoriness of the system that needs to be overthrown, the capitalist imperialist system. That it's the basic contradictions of this system, its fundamental contradiction between socialized production and private capitalist appropriation, and the driving force of anarchy as the main expression of that, but also other social contradictions that arise out of or are encompassed within the dynamics of this capitalist system. Contradictions which this system cannot resolve in any way, in any fundamental sense, and certainly not in the interests of the masses of people and ultimately all of humanity. This is the basis for revolution, not what people are thinking or doing at any given time, how many people are with it or against it at any given time, whether people give it thumbs up or thumbs down at any given time. All that is not the basis for revolution, but the basis lies in these contradictions of the system itself. So that is something that's being spoken to here when it speaks to how determinist realism doesn't really or fully grasp the contradictoriness of all of reality, including the necessity that one is confronted with at any given time. And elsewhere, I've also pointed out that necessity is not just necessity in some abstract sense, or not just obstacles and problems or difficulties to be overcome. Necessity itself is contradiction and should be understood in that way. And that is the basis on which necessity can be transformed into freedom through correctly analyzing and moving to transform necessity on a scientific basis. And it goes on to say, in the same paragraph, the second of these six paragraphs that begins part two of Making and Emancipating. So one of the essential features of determinist realism is that it dismisses as voluntarism any dialectical grasp of the relation between the subjective and objective factors, and sees things in very linear and undifferentiated ways, as essentially uniform and without contradiction, rather than in a living and dynamic and moving and changing way. Now, this too is extremely important. Because of the very nature of the contradictions, you know, in all of life, including human society and its interaction with the rest of reality and with nature, the fact is that different aspects of a contradiction can be transformed into each other. Mao pointed this out. You know, that consciousness can be transformed into matter, by which he wasn't saying that. Just as a side point here to clarify this, he wasn't saying that consciousness is something other than matter and motion, but he was speaking about matter broadly. The relationship between the particular form of matter and motion that is human consciousness on the one hand, and broader material reality on the other hand. And he was saying that the one can be and is constantly transformed into the other. This is a very important point we're stopping on for just a brief moment. Let's take the one transformation of the objective reality outside of human consciousness into human consciousness. If you think about this, this happens all the time. People interact with objective reality, and this is reflected in their consciousness. They make analyses, they make syntheses, and then what was objective becomes a part of their conscious, or if you will, subjective understanding. Not subjective in the sense that it's erroneous or based on bias or prejudice or unscientific methods, but subjective in the sense of the subject. People with their consciousness the relationship of that to objective reality outside of those people. That objective reality becomes transformed into the subjective in the sense that people become conscious of things and therefore move to change them in certain ways. So that's one way in which matter outside of the conscious human beings, matter outside of conscious human beings becomes transformed into consciousness. And the other is also true. On the basis of people making analyses and syntheses, in turn based on their interacting with reality, they go out into the world and act, and in that way affect the objective reality and change it. And so their subject, the consciousness of the subject, subjective in that sense, conscious matter goes out and changes the larger objective reality, and so becomes in that way part of that larger objective reality. The consciousness acting on that larger objective reality changes and then becomes part of it. When people put up with oppression because they don't see any way out, for example, that's one thing. When they, however, see the possibility and the necessity and become conscious of the possibility and necessity to act to change reality, then they actually do change it. You can see that within the history of any country. You know, look at the movements of the 1960s, for example, in the U.S. is just one example of how much of changes were made in the objective situation, even though, unfortunately, that didn't go all the way to a revolution, let alone where in societies, you know, even going back to the bourgeois era, like the French Revolution or the era of communist revolution in the Soviet Union and China, qualitative major changes have been brought about by people consciously reacting upon objective reality and their conscious actions actually changing and becoming encompassed within the changed objective reality. So this is a foundation underneath this statement that this determinist realism doesn't grasp the dialectical relation between the subjective and objective factors and sees things in very linear, undifferentiated ways as essentially uniform and without contradiction, rather than in a living and dynamic and moving and changing way. And in particular, doesn't grasp the possibility of acting on objective reality by grasping its contradictoriness and transforming it, even before the major qualitative transformation can be brought about that is represented by and encompassed in an actual proletarian or communist revolution in the non-reified but fullest sense. So this is very important, that because you find that people constantly up against difficult objective reality, especially in those circumstances, people fall into determinist realism. They see only one part of reality, not the whole picture of reality, and I'll get to that more. They also see reality only in a linear, undifferentiated way. In other words, not as full of contradiction, not as moving and changing as a result of the dynamics of those contradictions and the interaction of those contradictions as part of those overall dynamics. So that's one very important point, that if you don't look scientifically, if you don't apply materialism, and if you don't grasp if you don't apply dialectical materialism in particular, don't, in other words, grasp the contradictory nature of reality, of the necessity that you're up against and need to transform, then you bow down to necessity. You see all that can be done as being what is, as Lenin put it, what is possible What is desirable is what is possible. What is possible is what is already being done, is another way that Lenin very sharply poses the same kind of outlook. And that's what you fall into if you don't you don't approach it as a materialist. You approach this as an idealist. You know, you approach it as if, you know, this is, we've talked about this many times, this is just one set of precepts or narrative up against another, and it's not really proceeding on the basis of objective reality, it's just proceeding on the basis of subjective in the other sense. That is, you know, prejudiced, biased, you know, inclinations that are not based on objective reality, but based just on wishes or prayers or whatever. You know, if you approach things in that way, you don't even have a, you don't even have a prayer. You don't have a chance of actually transforming objective reality, certainly not in any fundamental sense, in terms of radically transforming society, in terms of overthrowing an existing system and bringing to being a radically different system. You, because you're just sort of, you know, you're just proceeding on the basis of, you know, ideas that you or other people have cooked up that are divorced from reality. It's difficult enough to transform reality if you're actually proceeding on the basis of actually looking at and digging into objective reality. But if you aren't, you cannot end up in a good place ultimately. But at the same time, if you just look at objective reality as it is and see it in this kind of linear way, as not as moving and changing, and in particular not as full of, not in terms of its being full of and driven by contradiction, then you also can't really recognize the possibility and basis for change, certainly not any fundamental change. So this is how the point about where the basis for revolution lies and what is the method and approach and epistemology for even being able to recognize that and correctly analyze it meets up with the question of whether or not you can actually transform society and have an orientation toward transforming it, or whether you don't see that possibility or start out with that kind of orientation, but as soon as you run into real obstacles, you retreat from it and bow down before necessity, or you flip into voluntarism and try by mere acts of will to change objective reality on a subjective basis without proceeding scientifically in a way that it cannot be changed, and certainly not for the better. That is, not in a radically emancipatory way toward the goal of communism. So that all that is concentrated in these first two paragraphs, and in particular we've been looking at the second paragraph of Making and Emancipating. There's a lot that's packed into, if you to use the parlance of the times, these six paragraphs. And this second paragraph is definitely, you know, one such case where there's a great deal concentrated in here. Terms are used which are on a high level of abstraction. Terms and concepts are used which are on a high level of abstraction because they are concentrating a tremendous amount. And the point is not to look at them and go, oh, I don't understand that, so I guess I'll look at something else. Or, oh, that's heavy, but I don't know what it means. The point is to dig into and really grapple with what is concentrated there and get into the fullness of what's being concentrated. Now, moving down a little later in these six paragraphs, I want to focus on what's said in the paragraph that begins, "It is true that we cannot, by our mere will, or even merely by our actions themselves, transform the objective conditions in a qualitative sense, into a revolutionary situation." Toward the middle of that paragraph, the very important point is discussed, taking off from Lenin's statement that, as he made it with regard to the labor aristocracy, that nobody could say for certain where all of the labor aristocracy would line up in relationship to the proletarian revolution in the event of such a revolution, when it actually came down to it. Nobody can say exactly how that would fall out, Lenin emphasized. And here, that same kind of approach and same basic formulation is applied to the question as follows. Applying the same principle, we can say that nobody can say exactly what the conscious initiatives of the revolutionaries might be capable of producing in reacting upon the objective situation at any given time. And I'm going to stop there because this does hark back to what I was just discussing. Reacting back upon the objective situation is not simply reacting back on an undifferentiated, monolithic objective situation, but reacting back upon a contradictory objective situation and transforming it in the way that I was just speaking to, beginning with the point from Mao about how matter can be transformed into human consciousness and human consciousness in turn can be transformed into broader matter. So I wanted to stop there to focus on what is meant by this phrase and how should this phrase be correctly understood, reacting upon the objective situation at any given time. It doesn't just mean doing what you do in relation, what you think you can do in relation to the objective situation. It means actively seeking to transform it, as is emphasized a little later, to the maximum degree possible at any given time or in any given set of circumstances. But here again, I want to emphasize this. Nobody can say exactly what the conscious initiatives of the revolutionaries might be capable of producing in reacting upon the objective situation at any given time. In part because nobody can predict all the other things that all the different forces in the world will be doing. Now, I have heard that this phrase and this formulation and how it's discussed here has been taken to mean, you know, once again interpreted through, frankly, revisionist determinist realism as, well, nobody can say, so it, you know, almost as if, so it doesn't, the point is it doesn't really matter what we do because you can't really know what you're going to be, what result it's going to have, so it's sort of aimless. No, that's not the point at all. The point is not that we should be carrying out aimless work, and I'll get into that further as we go along. Quite the contrary, we should be carrying out purposeful work. But the point here is that there is a larger objective world out there that is once again full of and driven by contradictions and undergoing transformation of one kind or another all the time through the dynamics of the contradictions and the interaction of those contradictions. So there's a much larger world, and whatever we're doing at a given time, even if it's along the correct lines and taking up the main contradictions that we can identify as what should be worked on, in other words, struggled over to transform at any given time, there's still a much larger world, and there is the role of what, in the framework of what we're doing, is accident. Things that didn't arise out of the dynamics on which we're working and which we can, even the larger dynamics we can identify at a given time. So there's that, including because all kinds of forces are operating, forces of nature are operating. You know, we can't predict all the, you know, floods, you know, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes. Oh, you know, science can have some, you know, has some sense of how some of these things might come about, but not all that can be predicted by human beings at this time. And then there's also all the social forces that are at work. Different class forces and their political and literary representatives are all operating out of there, all operating out there in the larger world. And all this is interacting with what we're doing in one way or another, on one level or another, or on many levels. So while we, in being scientific, have to, as this, those two paragraphs on some principles on building a movement for revolution say, we have to work to identify at any given time the major concentrations of social contradictions and go to work on them. Other forces are working on them, and there's a lot more happening in the world, including nature out there and so on and so forth. And sometimes not so out there, sometimes right inside here, wherever we are. So, you know, this is the larger dynamic world that we're dealing with, and universe that we're dealing with. So even when we correctly are working on the basis of correctly identifying the major concentrations of social contradictions, all these other things are happening, and they interpenetrate with, impinge upon, if you will, influence what we're working on and how people are seeing things, including the contradictions that we're working on at a given time. So that the meaning of this is not a constraining meaning. Nobody can say, well, we do our best, but no, you know, you can't know if it'll come to anything good. No, that's not the point at all. The point is we work to transform the objective situation and the direction in which it can and needs to go in terms of the emancipation of humanity. In other words, toward the goal of communism at any given time. maximizing transformations in that direction to the greatest degree possible at any given time, but also being alert to the fact that all these other things are happening out there. And even if you, here's the point, which gets developed more fully a little later here in this part of this section of part two of Making and Emancipating. Even if you could sit down and say, well, if we made the best analysis we could of the effect, the most positive possible effect of all the work that we're doing to transform things, particularly in relation to the major concentrations of social contradictions that we've identified, all that still at this point wouldn't lead to revolution. Even if that were scientifically true, the point of nobody can say is there might be a lot of other things happening out there which might at any given time come together with what we're doing to radically transform the situation, even possibly all the way to a revolutionary situation when we had not at any given point anticipated that possibility. That's the point of nobody can say exactly as applied to this. And it's not to promote agnosticism, oh, who knows, but it's to promote science, including a scientific recognition of the interrelation of accident and causality, the interrelation of larger things happening out there through the motion and development of contradictions and those dynamics, and what we're consciously approaching in terms of seeking to transform reality. So that's a very important understanding that's concentrated in this paragraph when it's speaking about the principle of nobody can say exactly. Now this relates to another, you know, the point toward the end of the same paragraph where it says what I was just touching on. And this I think is very important. There is the fact that although changes in what's objective for us won't come entirely, or perhaps not even mainly, through our working on the objective conditions in some direct one-to-one sense, nevertheless, our working on them can bring about certain changes within a given framework of objective conditions, and the word and is emphasized here, and in conjunction with and as part of a mix, together with many other elements, including other forces acting on the objective situation from their own viewpoints, this can, under certain circumstances, be part of the coming together of factors which does result in a qualitative change. In other words, even possibly all the way to a revolutionary situation. And again, the end of this paragraph goes on, and again, it is important to emphasize that nobody can know exactly how all that will work out. And here's an irony, which is another way of saying a contradiction, not only for us, but for all these other class forces out there. And look what it says here. That this, you know, in conjunction, what we're doing and the effects of it, in conjunction with and as part of a mix, together with many other elements, including other forces acting on the objective situation from their own viewpoints, can come together and create even a qualitative change, or make possible the bringing about of a qualitative change, even to a revolutionary situation. And the irony and contradiction, not only for us, but for these other forces, is here all these other forces acting on the objective terrain, trying to take it in a direction other than where it needs to go in terms of the emancipation of the oppressed of the world and ultimately all of humanity. And yet, if we're working correctly with the correct orientation and the correct scientific method that's concentrated in what's said here and is based on dialectical materialism, the things that they're doing to influence these other class forces and social forces, the things they're doing to influence the terrain can be things that we in turn go to work on to make it move toward a revolutionary situation. So this also should not be understood in linear terms. Oh, you know, these other class forces are contributing to the revolution too by what they... No, they're actually working against it, but then those are contradictions. What they're doing and the effects of that are also contradictions that we go to work on. So this is the living and dynamic way we have to understand the process of transforming the objective conditions, including the thinking of masses of people, which we'll get to more directly a little later, in the direction toward the communist revolution that's necessary, as opposed to either just idealist voluntarism. We just go out there, and because what we're saying is, you know, morally better, then it'll just somehow prevail, which is another form of religion, if you will. You know, or is much, much more common and much more powerful of a pull, this determinist realism that there really isn't much we can do until, as it's said in another part of these paragraphs, some deus ex machina, some, you know, almost supernatural external factor intervenes and saves us by making the, you know, whether it's, you know, objective changes, whether it's God, whether it's the masses who have replaced God, you know, or whatever, intervenes to save us and makes possible the all, you know, revolution when before that it was just, there was no basis for it anywhere. Now, these views are completely wrong and have to be thoroughly broken with in order to actually carry out revolutionary work, in order to actually carry out the principles for building a movement for revolution. And the last point I want to dig into in these six paragraphs, and it should be obvious in reading them and also in what I've touched on here, how important it is to continually go back to these six paragraphs and really dig into and get inside of what it's actually saying, and, you know, and the method and approach that it embodies. But here is sort of what sums it up, is where it's, oh no, I'm sorry, there's one other formulation I want to get to before I get to the end. That's this point that starts the paragraph, you know, which deals with the deus ex machina, where it starts out saying, revolution is not made by formulas or by acting in accordance with stereotypical notions and preconceptions. It is much more living, rich. It is a much more living, rich, and complex process than that. So this is also important. You know, the revisionists always approaching things, you know, again in linear and undialectical ways, not seeing the contradictions, and like, you know, let's, you know, and thinking that they can compress reality into something manageable for them, and then let's have a recipe for how we're going to accomplish things, and maybe even how we're going to accomplish somehow getting to socialism. You know, let's take a little of this and a little of that, and then first we do this, then we do that, and eventually somehow all this will all, you know, add up by, you know, if we just do the formula right, it'll all add up to some kind of change that would be good. You know, there's a lot of that out there, broadly speaking, in what we get loosely and somewhat charitably referred to as the movement. You know, and it's a characteristic of revisionism as well. You know, that you do try to approach things by formulae, rather than by grasping the living dynamics in the way that I've been speaking to. So I just want to underscore that point. Saying that revolution is not made by formulas doesn't mean that the work is aimless, that you don't have a strategic approach, that you don't actually make very scientific analyses and syntheses as part of continually refining your strategic approach and developing such a strategic approach in the first place. But science tells you precisely that the world is much more complex than this, that it is much more dynamic, that it can't be wrapped up into a neat package, that you can't have a formula for, you know, first we do this, then we do that, this will lead to that, this will lead to that, this will lead to that, and eventually the end point will be socialism, if not now, maybe 100 years from now. You know, so I still remember that revisionist who was working on the Bob Scheer campaign for Congress, you know, back in the 1960s. You know, he was running for in the Democratic Party, but running on an anti-war and anti-racism platform. And he didn't win, but he got quite a few votes. And this revisionist, as the votes were being announced, turned to all the rest of us sitting in the office and said, "Now I can go home and sleep well, knowing we're 1 centimeter closer to socialism." No. That's not the way that you get closer to socialism. That's not the way. And the point, after all, is not to get centimeter by centimeter by centimeter closer to some variation of some idea of socialism, but it's actually to apply this living, scientific, dialectical, materialist approach, recognizing that, yes, you do have to have things that you identify as contradictions that you're putting concerted effort and concentrated effort on working to transform at any given time. But you also, even as you're doing that, have to look at the much broader world. how other social forces are acting, not just on the contradictions that you're focusing on, but on the larger contradictions of society, what nature is doing and how that's impacting society, and what different effects it's having on different sections of society in different parts of the world and so on, and how all that sets in motion or transforms the motion of different contradictions, all of which you have to be encompassing in a basic sense as part of your strategic approach to actually carrying forward the struggle to transform the objective world toward the goal of the ultimate goal of communism and the more immediate goal of overthrowing the existing system and establishing the socialism with the dictatorship of the proletariat. So that does get back to the very end of this, where it sort of sums it up, where it says, if you were looking at things, and this is the end of the sixth paragraph, if you're looking at things only in a linear way, then you only see the possibilities that are straight ahead. You don't see the contradictions, and you have blinders on. You only see what's right in front of you. You have a kind of blinders on, as it says. On the other hand, if you have a correct dialectical materialist approach, you recognize that many things can happen that are unanticipated, and you have to be constantly tense to that possibility. And this is a very concentrated last part of the sentence, so I want to emphasize it word by word almost. If you have a correct dialectical materialist approach, you recognize that many things that can happen are unanticipated, and you have to be constantly tense to that possibility while consistently working to transform necessity into freedom. And there's so much concentrated in that last part, beginning with, you recognize that many things can happen that are unanticipated, and you have to be constantly tense to that possibility while consistently working to transform necessity into freedom. Here again is another contradiction. Being constantly tense to the possibility of things that arise unexpectedly, to put it in a certain way, on the one hand, while on the other hand, consistently working to transform necessity into freedom, particularly in light of what you can identify as the main contradictions you need to be working on at any given time or any given period. That is a very important contradiction, and at times can be a very acute contradiction, because you can be burrowed into what you're doing to try to transform what you see as the main things that need to be worked on at any given time to be transformed, and you can lose sight of these larger things, and you're taken totally by surprise, you know, by unexpected developments, or you just ignore those developments because they don't fit into your formula, to your narrow agenda. So it is worth going back to that last sentence of these six paragraphs, and particularly the last half of that last sentence, and really going and digging into it and discussing it and wrangling with it individually, but above all collectively, over and over again. So these six paragraphs rest on a certain material foundation. They're not just talking about an approach of a subjective kind that proceeds out of the bright ideas of somebody, or out of the, you know, biases and, you know, of people, and or their, you know, inclinations of an idealist kind of how they like the world to be and what should be possible. All this is grounded in a scientific approach to analyzing material reality, basing yourselves in the actual contradictions of material reality and the possibilities for transformation that lie within all that, and how that relates to the goal of communism. Now, let's look at that. Is the goal of communism just a goal, and then you look at the contradictions of objective reality and see how it relates to that goal? No, the goal itself is based on analyzing material reality and its contradictoriness in a scientific way. As has been emphasized, but can't be emphasized too many times, it seems, the actual understanding of both the possibility, necessity, and desirability, well, that's three things, not both, but of all that, the possibility, the necessity, and the desirability of communism is based on an analysis of the material reality and its contradictoriness and the motion and dynamics and transformation that this gives rise to, and the potential within that to realize this goal of a revolution ultimately leading to communism on a world scale. So this fundamental approach is what's being applied and applied in a very concentrated way in these six paragraphs. And it's not only in those six paragraphs, not the only place it's applied, but it is what's being applied in a very concentrated way there. And that's why I've also said these paragraphs are a very, you know, important, essential concentration of not only points of strategic approach in a general sense, but also of method and of epistemology, which, you know, is at the heart of that method. The scientific epistemology, which leads to, you know, a scientific approach and method. So on that basis, let's go forward and talk about the strategic approach of hastening while awaiting itself. Now again, as I've been emphasizing, this is in opposition, on the one hand, to voluntarism. It's not hastening, you know, like a you know, speed up of the assembly line, you know, just moving faster and faster and faster, you know, and digging ourselves a deeper, deeper hole going nowhere. It's not, you know, running around frenetically on the basis of, you know, we've got to make revolution, the world's terrible, you know, people are suffering, we have to, yes, we should have that kind of passion, but not freneticism. There's a very important distinction between passion and freneticism. Because freneticism is opposed to and undermines a scientific approach. Hastening while awaiting is an opposition to a kind of a voluntarist approach. Well, you know, so many deeds, as Mao said very correctly, cry out to be done, so let's just try to do everything at once without any materialist assessment of the objective reality and of our own, you know, where we are in relation to that objective reality and what we can transform that will lead in the direction of where we need to go on a scientific foundation, as opposed to just what we'd like to be able to do. I mean, if we just want to do that, we just try to have a revolution right now and get crushed, which would be very bad. You know, to actually try to seize power now would be very bad and would demoralize the masses and disorient them and set back the whole struggle, and not only in a particular country, but in the world as a whole for quite a while and very seriously. So that kind of voluntarism, again, is no good. But as has been emphasized, and once again can't be emphasized, it seems, too many times, there is a much stronger pull of off the revolutionary road represented by determinism. That, again, and it actually links up with and has a fundamental unity with idealism and voluntarism in particular, because it is actually a form of idealism. Determinism is actually a form of idealism. It can be expressed as mechanical materialism. That is, you see objective reality, but you see it only in, you know, as uniform, without contradiction, unchanging, not moving and transforming, etc. So it can take form and be an expression of mechanical materialism. But that mechanical materialism is also ultimately also a form of idealism. Because you're not actually analyzing and synthesizing objective reality in a scientific way, and therefore you don't recognize the contradictoriness of it, and therefore you don't see the possibility of transforming the objective condition, and you don't see everything I was just talking about. Not only the ways in which you can transform things, but the ways in which things are being transformed by other forces, social and even, quote-unquote, natural forces, that are constantly at work, according to their own inner contradictions and dynamics and the interaction of these different contradictions. So once again, what's concentrated in those six paragraphs from part two, first six paragraphs from part two of Making and Emancipating, has direct bearing on our strategic approach and is, you know, concentrates some key things about that strategic approach. So let's talk a little bit about what is that strategic approach? Let's get to that more directly. It has been concentrated. We've written about this in many places. It's spoken to in works like Making and Emancipating, and especially Part 2, and also in Birds and Crocodiles. Birds cannot give birth to crocodiles, but humanity can soar beyond the horizon, particularly in Part 2 of that work. But it's also very directly and in a concentrated way set forth in the Statement on the Strategy for Revolution, which is also the supplement to the third third chapter of Basics on the question of revolution. So let's look at different elements of this, but not as just isolated elements unto themselves, but as part of an overall strategic approach. One of the key elements of this approach, which is emphasized in the statement on the strategy for evolution, is encapsulated or concentrated in the slogan, "Fight the power and transform the people for revolution." Now, in the interview that I did with A. Brooks, "What Humanity Needs, Revolution and the New Synthesis of Communism," I talked about the relationship or important aspects of the relationship between fighting the power and transforming the people and people transforming themselves. And, you know, the critical role that's played by people standing up and fighting back against oppression. That if people, you know, to put it negatively, if people do not stand up and fight back against oppression, then there is much less of a basis, certainly, you know, in an overall sense for revolution, but also for people to grasp and to be open to understanding and to be seeking to understand the reality that they are caught up in and what is both necessary and possible in terms of transforming that reality. So that's a point that's emphasized in that interview, and it's a very important point. But what's also given emphasis, and is even more important in an overall sense, is that all three parts, if you will, of this slogan are both important, yes, in themselves as aspects of this, but most importantly, they are important, most essentially they are important as a unified whole, even though they are, in other words, in their interrelation and in the totality of this slogan, which is greater than any of its particular parts, or even greater than the sum of the parts taken as such. In other words, to put it another way, there's a dialectical interconnection between fighting the power, transforming the people, and the fact that this has to ultimately go for revolution. And fundamentally, in terms of where it needs to go, it has to be aiming for revolution, or else all the other aspects are going to be set back. The aspect of people standing up and resisting, fighting the power in that sense, the aspect of people seeking to understand the world more deeply and being open to and being in fact transformed in their thinking is going to be set back, because the terms and the dynamics of the existing system are going to continue to operate on people. And if there's not a rupture to an actual revolution, that's going to reassert itself. And we've seen that. And once again, if you look through the whole experience of the 60s into the early 70s and what's happened since, things that some of us who were around there could not have imagined would ever happen in terms of how the social relations have been transformed in a reversal of some changes that were made, and in terms of the way the thinking of people's been transformed in a backward and reactionary way on a very great scale since that time, because revolution, it didn't go all the way, it didn't break through all the way to revolution, didn't break on through to the other side, to use that line from the song. So, you know, there's an integral whole here, and all these different parts, the different components, fight the power and transform the people, and for revolution are interconnected. But for revolution is what gives it its ultimate decisive definition. So that's one important point. Now, again, it is important that people stand up and fight back. And, you know, the outrages that this system continually perpetrates against masses of people, as well as against the environment, all over the world, not just in one country, do, in fact, provide a basis for people to stand up and fight back. But in and of itself, just the fact that people are oppressed and that the system does horrific things does not, you know, in every instance lead to people resisting, to people fighting the power, if you will. And it certainly doesn't lead to that fight being sustained. So on the one hand, these outrages of the system, these egregious abuses of the system, these injustices and oppression of the system and exploitation do need to be fought. They are themselves real contradictions that people need to develop struggle around. At the same time, if you're approaching all this with the science of dialectical materialism, not with the narrative of communism, but with the science of dialectical materialism, you know that all this has to be developed in an overall and fundamental sense toward the goal of revolution, aiming for the ultimate aim of communism on a world scale. even as, and this is very important, and I'll talk about this more a little later, even as it's very important to work to unite as many people as possible to fight against these outrages who come at this from a diversity of viewpoints, and many of whom are not at any given time one, two, or convinced that all this has to go toward revolution and the ultimate goal of communism. If we don't seek to unite with everybody who is outraged or can be one to see what an outrage it is that these injustices and exploitation and oppression go on, then we are going to be undermining, in the fundamental sense, our basic objectives of revolution, which is not just, again, our narrative, but is what is actually necessary to finally and fully eliminate all such outrages and injustices. On the other hand, if we just... So that's on the one side and very important. And I've emphasized this before, and I want to emphasize it again. These outrages are real outrages. And if we, who claim to be revolutionaries and communists, are not in fact more outraged by this, or certainly not less outraged by these things, than other people who do not have a communist understanding and approach, then we are not deserving of the name of communist, not deserving of the name of revolutionary. If we don't have a deep hatred and passion to eliminate these things and to fight against them even before and all along the way in order to fully and finally eliminate them, then we are not revolutionaries and we are not communists. We should certainly have no less passion about this, no less outrage than other people who do not have a communist understanding and a scientific, dialectical, materialist method and approach at any given time. So I want to emphasize that all that on the one side. On the other side of the contradiction, if we only give expression to our hatred for these things, if we are only passionate in fighting them ourselves and mobilizing other people and bringing forward other people to fight them, but we don't, in what we do, not what we expect others who are not communists to do, let's be clear, but in what we do, if we do not actually bring forward the fact that all this has to go toward revolution and the ultimate goal of communism, then we are also betraying the mass of people, and we are also leaving things ultimately to the not-so-tender mercy of the dynamics of this system and its state and its ruling class. And what this system will do in relation to these contradictions in seeking to resolve it on its terms. So that's again, another contradiction that we have to correctly handle. And if we are wrong on either aspect of this, or on the synthesis of the two aspects, then we are not going to be doing what we need to do, and we are actually ultimately going to be doing harm instead of what we need to be doing to actually lead people to stand up and fight more and more consciously to achieve, yes, their own emancipation through the revolution leading to the ultimate goal of communism. So that's one point I want to emphasize in terms of fight the power and transform the people for revolution. The other point I want to stress is that within this entire process of fight the power and transform the people for revolution, and within the entire overall process of building the movement for revolution and building the party as its leading core, what is most essential and pivotal is transforming the thinking of not just this individual and that individual isolated by themselves, although struggling with individuals can be a part of this and is a part of it, but the pivotal role of transforming the thinking of blocks of people, of whole groups of people, of masses of people, ultimately. Now, what do I mean by saying it's pivotal and most essential? Let's be clear, that does not mean the solitary, the only element or aspect of this that's important. People actually standing up and fighting, as I've been stressing, is important as well. But if we look at this as an overall process, even we should be able to recognize, and we will recognize if we're approaching it scientifically, that even in order for people to stand up and fight, and certainly to sustain a fight, as they run into different obstacles and twists and turns and so on and so forth, people's thinking has to be transformed. Now, in something I've written, I said, I posed the question to try to put things in very basic and concentrated, in a certain sense, simple terms. Who should be involved, for example, I'll talk about this more a little bit later, who should be involved in the mass initiatives that we've undertaken? On the one hand, to put it in short, concentrated terms, against the degradation of women, and on the other hand, mass incarceration and everything bound up with that. Who should be involved in these mass initiatives? And the answer is everyone. The way I formulated it was, everyone who understands or can be one to see that these outrages that these mass initiatives are taking up are intolerable and must be fought. Which should be said, and it should be understood, but apparently needs to be said. It should not be limited by any means to communists and a few people gathered around the communists. That should include growing numbers of people, in the hundreds of, very soon in the thousands, and ultimately millions. But let's look at that formulation. Who understand or can be one to see. Now, what's implied, particularly in the part within that is there, or can be one to see? It implies that people have to be struggled with. People have to often be struggled with to recognize these outrages, even to see them sometimes, because of the way this system operates and how it blinds people. And how it encourages people in many ways to blind themselves to many of these outrages. So people have to be struggled with in many instances, many cases, just to recognize these outrages. And then to recognize them as outrages. And then to recognize that they are not the fault of the people who were subjected to them. Even before they come to understand the whole thing, scientifically, in terms of all this flows from the system and is encompassed within the dynamics of the system. There's still struggle with people that has to be, and everybody who's gone out to do any of this kind of work knows this, struggle has to be waged to get people to see the necessity to fight these things. And to understand in basic terms that the people who are being oppressed in this way are not the ones responsible. It's not their fault, the personal responsibility. All these other kind of lines out there, bullshit that leads people away from understanding correctly in basic terms. Even the fact that this is an injustice. You have to transform people's thinking. And how do you transform people's thinking? Through struggle. We'll come back to that. Overwhelmingly, when you're among the masses of people, this is non-antagonistic struggle. Not struggle with the enemy. But it's struggle, and sometimes very sharp struggle. And sometimes, and in many ways, relentless struggle. So even in order to get people moving, and even the people who are directly oppressed by and are the victims, if you will, of this oppression. There's often needs to be, and generally needs to be, a lot of struggle with them to get them to stand up and fight these things. I was reading something, I believe was on our website, about people going out talking about mass incarceration with some of these basic youth, mass incarceration, police brutality, the criminalization of the youth, all that. And some of the youth who are directly under the gun, literally, of this, were asked, well, what do you think about this? And one said, I don't have any thoughts about it. Another one said, well, I don't like it, but there's nothing you can do about it. Now, in order to get people to stand up and fight the power, you're going to have to struggle with that. And again, as we've talked about previously, there's the pull once people do get moving. In mass movements, in struggles that are unleashed around these contradictions, there's the striving to come under the wing of the bourgeoisie. There's the way in which the bourgeoisie or its political representatives and literary representatives throw up obstacles or throw up, entice people into traps or make pretty sounding phrases or respond to a contradiction around mass incarceration and police murder and vigilante murder of black and Latino youth by saying the problem is that we have to get the males to stand up and be better patriarchs. Thank you very much, President Obama, for a very insightful and new analysis that really will lead to people being liberated. To use that old phrase from a while back, not! So, anyway, this kind of thing, there's going to be continual struggle for all these reasons. And this is dialectically related to fighting the power, to standing up and fighting back, to resisting. Think about it. If people do themselves stand up and fight back, and they even see other people standing up and fighting back, that becomes another way in which, to go back to the point with which I started, matter gets transformed into consciousness, and how it does is a point of struggle too, but people see that and they say, oh, Maybe it is possible to do something about this. I thought nobody else cared. Now I see other people do. That is a change in their consciousness. Now where it goes, and whether it goes right back into the bourgeois framework, or whether there's, you know, whether there's an actual movement to take it somewhere where it needs to go, is a matter of struggle. It's a matter of transforming the thinking of people. Again, not just an individual here and there, although that can be important in certain contexts. But blocks of people, groups of people, masses of people. So there's this, and then, you know, when people's thinking changes, then they feel more compelled to act in certain ways. So this is an ongoing dialectic back and forth, through which, in an overall sense, if you will, sort of like a thread running through it, pivotal to all of it in an overall sense, is transforming the thinking of blocks of people. It doesn't mean that we have to just go out and preach at people to change their thinking. You know, like one of the reverends out there, whatever, you know, or the priests or whatever, you know, let's get people to be, you know, to change their thinking and to be in line with some grand design that we have. No, it means actually struggling with people to see the world as it actually is, more and more deeply and in a more and more all-around way, comprehensive way, and to act accordingly even as they are acting. And certainly, in order for people to come to see the basis and the need for revolution, and the desirability of revolution, if you will, there needs to be a tremendous amount of struggle carried out in an ongoing way, even as, and this again I want to emphasize this, that on the one hand, as being essential, struggling to transform the thinking of people in most fundamental terms toward recognizing the necessity and possibility and desirability of revolution leading to the ultimate goal of communism, while at every point in dialectical relation to that, we are uniting and bringing forward people as broadly as possible to wage struggle around and against the outrages of the system, and particularly where that takes form as concentrations of major social contradictions. And in that overall process, the struggle to transform the thinking of blocks of people is most essential and pivotal, but it is most essential and pivotal in that overall process and the dialectics of that process. Neither as a thing unto itself, nor as something set aside just for special occasions, but as pivotal in this overall process. So that's something I want to emphasize very strongly. The next point I want to speak to is, and this is something that has been spoken to in the recent speech and film, Revolution Nothing Less, also in part 2 of Birds and Crocodiles. And that is the relation between everything we are doing now and on the possibility of revolution. That is, how, when there are radically different objective conditions, such that there is things are on the precipice of or actually being transformed into a revolutionary situation, and there is one key feature of that, there is a revolutionary-minded people at least, people who are at least revolutionary-minded, seeking out radical change in the millions and millions. How, at that time, the key task and the pivot of everything then becomes actually developing and waging the struggle for the seizure of power. That is not the direct goal, it is not the pivotal and immediate task now, in this period. But what is the relationship between what we are doing now and in this period in carrying out the strategy for revolution, in carrying forward the dialectical process of fight the power and transform the people for revolution, in transforming the thinking of blocks of people as pivotal within that overall dialectical process? What is the relationship between all that and what is set forth in the document on the possibility of revolution, speaking to the struggle for the seizure of power when the objective conditions have come into being for that, including a revolutionary people, or at least a revolutionary-minded people seeking out, actively seeking radical change in the millions and millions? Well, obviously that could be a subject for a whole, not only one discussion, but ongoing series of discussions in its own right. But here I just want to touch on some key points. First of all, the fact that there is and must be a relation, a dialectical relation between the two things, between everything we are doing in this period and what's concentrated in the document on the possibility for revolution, speaking to the struggle for the seizure of power when that is the order of the day, when those are the conditions, which again are radically different from the conditions now. And I emphasize that it's important just for people to correctly grasp the basic fact that there is an ongoing relationship. That it's not a matter of somehow what we're doing now is over here in a self-contained bubble, so to speak, and over here somehow completely separated from that, and something that has not, you know, is only for some abstract, indefinite future, is the question of on the possibility of revolution and what it concentrates. Yes, there is a qualitative change that has to come about. Yes, they are qualitatively different. There should not be any confusion about that. They are not just a continuum without a qualitative leap, both in the objective situation and in the nature of the tasks of the communists and of the challenges of the revolution, if you will. But they are related. Otherwise, what's the point? If we're not actually working to hasten while awaiting to bring closer and to help transform the conditions toward a revolutionary situation and to be in the best possible position to seize on that situation when it is brought into being, then what's the point of anything we're doing? Once again, you go back to the polemic against Alain Badiou. If there isn't a revolution, if there isn't a defeat and dismantling of the exploitative, oppressive, and repressive relations and institutions of this system, and their replacement by revolutionary relations and institutions and processes and dynamics, then all of this, you know, is going to continue, as that polemic says. You know, the world will go on as it is with the machinery of imperialism humming in the background, capitalism and imperialism humming in the background, crushing lives and destroying spirits, to paraphrase. So all of this is aiming for something. It's aiming for not just a revolution in the way the term is thrown around sometimes these days, where there's a change in government, who's in the government, or even a change in the form of the bourgeois existing oppressive and exploitative, government and the system of capitalism, imperialism, and related systems of exploitation that are enforced by that governing system. You know, that's not a revolution. Now, popular uprising, even millions in the street, you know, sincerely calling for change, does not itself constitute a revolution and will not bring about a real revolution. Elsewhere, I pointed out what a revolution is and isn't. But it is, you know, an overturning of the existing system, a defeating and dismantling of its forces of repression and its concentrated forces of violence that are used to enforce the present system, and the replacement of all that with a radically different system. Radically different system economically, in terms of social relations, in terms of political institutions and processes, and in terms of the culture and thinking of the people. That's what a revolution is. And if we are not preparing for that revolution, then we are doing worse than wasting our time. We're also wasting the time of the masses of people, but we're doing more and worse than that. We're actually leading them into, once again, the killing embrace of the existing system and its apparatus and institutions of brutal and violent force and repression to maintain that system. So what we're doing, to go back to hastening while awaiting, is actively seeking, once again, as it's concentrated in those six paragraphs that I was speaking to at the beginning, from Making and Emancipating, is we're transforming the objective conditions to the greatest degree possible at any given time, while also being alert to changes that arise from larger factors, from the development of other contradictions and other forces working on those contradictions from their own point of view and with their own objective. We're seeking to transform the conditions so that we not only are just passively awaiting, but we're actually changing the situation in ways that accelerate on a materialist basis, and not and not through attempted application of voluntarism, but on a materialist basis, to actually accelerate things toward the development of a revolutionary situation and the emergence of a revolutionary people in the millions and millions, and also prepare the masses of people, growing numbers of the masses, and their leadership, the vanguard party at the core of the movement for revolution, prepare them to seize on this revolutionary situation when in fact it does come into being, not just through our work, but through this overall process that I was examining and which is presented in a concentrated way in the first six paragraphs of part two of Making and Emancipating. That's what it means to hasten while away. We're working with a purpose. It's not aimless. It's not purposeless. It's not by formulae. It's not by some sort of recipe. It's not by a linear approach. We do this, we do that, and we get 1 centimeter, then 4 centimeters. Let's even be a little bit more dialectical than that of a revisionist. You know, it's not just 1 centimeter and then another centimeter. Wow! 1 centimeter and then 8 centimeters closer to socialism on the same straight line linear approach. No. It's actually working to transform the conditions to ones more favorable for evolution in the context of all that's spoken to in terms of the larger objective world that's going on, all that's spoken to in those six paragraphs, or in a concentrated way, in the six paragraphs that begin part two of Making and Emancipating. It's doing that on the one hand while also preparing growing numbers of the masses and a growing party at the core leading the masses in preparing the ground for revolution. So that when things do come together, when through our work and these larger dynamics, there actually does emerge either the qualitative change or the possibility of our then working directly to transform the situation into a revolutionary one, then there is the strongest possible basis to actually seize on that and fight through and win. And that gets back to the point that everything we're doing is preparing for that. Everything we're doing is preparing. And we're not preparing in a direct sense. We're not organizing forces directly and in the particular sphere of fighting all out for the seizure of power. But we're working in an all-around way to accumulate the forces for revolution. In an accelerated way, not just in a slow, gradual, and linear way, but in an all-around and an accelerated way. So, on the one hand, and this is important, there is a qualitative distinction between the objective conditions, including the mood of the masses, and what the masses are prepared to do and what the party is actually prepared to lead them to do in this present period, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a qualitatively different situation, a revolutionary situation and revolutionary-minded masses. Those two things are qualitatively different, and they're not just a linear extension along the same continuum. They involve qualitative leaps along the way and a major qualitative leap to an actual revolutionary situation and a revolutionary people. On the other hand, they are not separated by an absolute wall. And what we are doing now is actively working, once again, to hasten developments in the objective situation and in terms of the consciousness and organization of masses of people and their vanguard party in preparation for, at the same time as working to bring closer and to accelerate the development of contradictions toward when such a qualitatively different situation would emerge, and then the task of communists become qualitatively different in a very telescoped and concentrated way, even as has been stressed, and on the possibility of revolution, the actual struggle for the seizure of power will be somewhat more protracted than had been previously understood and will not be simply a matter of simultaneous urban insurrections and then the establishment very quickly of a revolutionary regime. And again, it's worth going back to what's the original article on the possibility for revolution, to what's said about it in Revolution, Nothing Less, as well as in birds and crocodiles and really study and dig into and grapple with what's being said there. And then to grapple with the question that I'm now addressing of what that has to do with what we're doing now, even though the situation and the tasks, to put it that way, are qualitatively different now than they would be then. So that's just a point I want to give a lot of emphasis to, because if we are not, you know, look, you can see in microcosm, this is a very important point, even though the situation is qualitatively different now, you could see in microcosm at least some of what the features of a revolutionary situation will be like and what the life and death struggle will be like at that time. Not only with the direct representatives and enforcers of the existing system, their politicians and all their whole state apparatus of violent repression, but also with all other forces in the field who in a magnified way, just as we will be working on a magnified basis, will also be working on a magnified basis to try to transform the contradictions in the direction in which they want them to go. Various political and literary representatives of various strata of the petty bourgeoisie, including the petty bourgeoisie and bourgeois strata among oppressed peoples and nations, they are in the field now in certain ways. Many times, you know, directly and sometimes very viciously in opposition to what we're seeking to do to bring forward the masses around an actual revolutionary understanding and program and to accumulate forces for revolution in that way. You know, but also just more generally out in the field trying to win people to their program, which is objectively and sometimes very directly in opposition to how we're seeking to lead people to act, to recognize and act in their most fundamental interests. And just as that exists now, that will exist in a magnified way at the time of revolution. You know, Lenin made this point. A revolution is not something simple like one army lines up one place and says, we're for imperialism, and another army lines up somewhere else and says, we're for socialism, and then they have at it. There's all kinds of other forces in the field, some of which you'll be able to win over or at least unite with or win to friendly neutrality, and some of which will actually go over to the side of the bourgeoisie when it comes down to it, of the old system and the old ruling class. Again, that's one of those things where Lenin's statement applies. Nobody can say with certainty, and it would be wrong to try to predict with certainty. But this we can say. How much, you know, look, let's put it in very basic terms. We are in a contestation, not only with the direct political, literary, and yes, repressive representatives and forces of the existing oppressive and exploitative system, but also with many other class forces which are not the ruling class, but which represent programs and interests which will end up capitulating to, which left to their own dynamics, put it that way, will end up capitulating to, and even in some cases becoming actively enlisted in the forces of counter-revolution along with the ruling class of the old system. We are engaged in a struggle, you know, obviously with the representatives of the old system. It's an antagonistic struggle, even though the struggle now is not one for the seizure of power. The fundamental interests involved are antagonistic. We are also involved in all kinds of struggle, including particularly ideological struggle, but also a struggle, you know, which comes down over practical policies and programs for all different kinds of immediate struggles, with different forces out there representing all different kinds of interests which fundamentally cannot break with and will lead people back to within the killing confines of the existing system. And there is not a linear connection, but there is a definite connection between how that struggle is waged now and all along the way while we're hastening while awaiting, and then in a magnified and concentrated way, that will take a concentrated and magnified form. It will undergo a qualitative leap when there actually would be the emergence of a revolutionary situation and a revolutionary people. So it's neither the case that the terms are exactly now as they will be then. And again, Lenin's point comes in. Nobody can say exactly how these different forces will fall out and line up. That is also a matter of struggle and pull on them from different sides. So it's not that there is just a straight line on the one hand. On the other hand, it's not that there is no connection. There is a definite connection. There's a definite connection in that dimension and overall between everything we are doing and whether or not a revolutionary situation even fully ripens, and then can it actually be seized on by the vanguard forces of communist revolution to lead masses of people in an actual emancipatory breakthrough. One that ruptures out of and, you know, defeats the killing confines and repressive, violent repressive forces of the existing order and the existing system and its institutions and apparatuses. So we should be not linearly. That would be wrong on the one side. But even greater danger, an even greater danger is not to see the connection between everything we're doing all along the way and what will happen and what will be possible when there would be a qualitative change to a revolutionary situation and the emergence of a revolutionary people. If you think that, you know, you're just going to go along and be in a little corner somewhere, and then all of a sudden all of society is going to be convulsed in major upheavals, let alone a revolutionary situation, and then everybody's just going to come over to you because you have better ideas, you are betraying the masses of people, I'm sorry to say, in fundamental terms. If you are not actively working to transform the conditions, including the thinking of the people, and including what the people are actually, what growing numbers of people are actually organized around, then you are not preparing for revolution. And not only are you not preparing, you are actually preparing for a disaster if there is a major convulsion in society, even one that leads to a revolutionary situation. We are actively working on the terrain to prepare, as Lenin put it, or actually Lenin said, organize forces and prepare minds. We reversed it to get the dialectic more correctly in an overall sense. Preparing minds and organizing forces for revolution. That's what we're actively doing. Working on transforming the objective conditions and working on transforming the subjective factor, namely the party. Both qualitatively and quantitatively. That is, making it, you know, transforming it to be more and more on the scientific foundation and as a real revolutionary communist vanguard that it needs to be, and bringing forward growing numbers of people into the ranks of the party on that and no other basis. And also bringing forward growing numbers of masses and winning them more and more to move in a revolutionary direction and to be one to a revolutionary understanding and to act on that understanding. This is what we're doing, nothing else. It's not a matter of, okay, we got some assignments and we go out and we do this and we do that, totally disconnected from any kind of strategic approach. There's way too much of that. But that's not what needs to be done. That's not what cries out to be done. What cries out to be done is preparing minds and organizing forces, just as we're fighting the power and transforming the people for one thing, for revolution. Even as many of the people we're uniting with are not for that revolution at any given time. And that's the dialectics, the nature of the contradictions that we're dealing with, and that's the dialectical materialist method we have to correctly handle those contradictions. We're preparing minds and organizing forces for revolution. To put it another way, we're accumulating forces for revolution. That's very important. That is one of the major yardsticks by which we should measure what we're doing. Are we actually accumulating forces? Not just accumulating forces for any old thing, but are we actually, in this overall process, not that everybody we're involved with in any particular struggle or any particular mass initiative, not that all the people or even maybe a majority of the people at any given time are for revolution, but are we actually, through this overall process, which I've spoken to in many dimensions, are we through this overall process actually accumulating forces who are more and more consciously seeing the need, the basis, a need and basis for revolution, and actively working to bring closer and then to carry out that actual revolution, the actual, at when the time comes and the situation is qualitatively different, the actual defeat and dismantling of the old system and its forces of violent repression, and the bringing about of a radically different system. Are we accumulating forces who are actually more and more consciously working for that, and are part of that process where they're becoming, moving forward in a revolutionary direction and making the leap to join the party as part of that? Because after all, and this is something that's not understood in the way it should be, after all, the most essential, important force that needs to be organized in all this. Not the only, not the single, not the to the neglect of everything else force that needs to be organized, but in the midst of, and at the core of all this, this overall process, the most important force that needs to be organized is the vanguard force of the Communist Revolution. And in this country, that means the Revolutionary Communist Party.